Media Focus with Paul Blanchard.
This week, the editor of The Guardian steps down. After nearly 20 years at the top, Alan Rusbridger has announced he will depart next summer. We'll be discussing his successes and failures. The so-called VIP paedophile ring. National media has been slow to report allegations of an illicit network of politicians and VIPs, which operated over decades in the UK. What took the media so long? And looking back on 2014 and ahead to 2015, this year has been a busy one. From the police snooping on journalists, the phone hacking trial, and the death of BBC Three, we'll ask what was the biggest media story and make some predictions for 2015. And joining us as usual are two of the media's best and brightest. Alex Chandler is editor of ITV's election programme, and Matt Watts is editor-in-chief of X-Row.
Media Focus.
So first up, Alan Rusbridger has announced he's off. Having grown The Guardian into one of the most read digital newspapers in the world, his tenure is not without controversy, defending a number of prominent defamation suits, making everything available online for free, and publishing the Snowden leaks. Alex, do you think he's done a good job?
I do think he's done a good job. I think, actually, if you look at his record, he's one of the big figures on Fleet Street. And in a world where longevity is not part of the currency, he has endured and I think has a pretty impressive record of success. You mentioned the transformation that he brought about whilst at The Guardian, not just changing its format from a broadsheet to a Berliner when his rivals were going tabloid. He's taken The Guardian Unlimited, which was an early foray into online journalism, to be a fantastically successful and global brand. And, you know, for a small newspaper in the UK to get that sort of reach in the US and in Australia is a pretty impressive record. I think he spotted an opening and an opportunity and really went for it. But there's other things about the Guardian during his time which I think are impressive. You know, if you look at the stories which he championed just recently, phone hacking, the Snowden interview, the WikiLeaks relationship, and even back to Jonathan Aitken, Neil Hamilton, there's some pretty big scalps that he's taken in his time. And I think he'll be remembered with some affection in Fleet Street and also with a great deal of admiration.
No doubt there's been some strong editorial successes, but in terms of his business model, The Guardian is hemorrhaging money. It's losing nearly £40 million a year. I mean, do you think he should be responsible for that?
You're right, but I think as an editor, his job is to concentrate on the journalism. It's up to the management of the Scott Trust, and it'll be his job when he leaves the post as editor to manage the finances of the newspaper. You know, look, The Guardian's model is unique. It's set up as this foundation to preserve the independence of The Guardian and enshrine its future. And yes, of course, the finances of any newspaper are important. And let's face it, most newspapers are under enormous financial pressure. That's just part of the modern world. But actually, as editor, should he be worried about that? No, I don't think he should. I think he should be worried about the stories on his front page, his team of reporters, and the kind of journalism he's bringing to the arena.
Mark, what's your take?
I think I would say that the picture is a little bit more mixed than that. There are clear successes, there are clear journalistic successes in his time. Preeminent amongst them, I would say, are the Snowden revelations, but also the phone hacking story. So I agree with that. However, there are, and they're well-known journalistic successes. The Guardian has made sure everyone's aware of those successes, but there have been some notable failures, which are less well-known. And in particular, they really fouled up on an investigation that didn't run on Met corruption. And the two journalists concerned left under, shall we say, very dark circumstances. And certainly one of them turned up at the Sunday Times and ran a lot of very interesting material on that same subject. So that was a big miss. The Guardian went wrong there. A lot of dark whispers about how the Met applied pressure successfully to contain the Guardian on that, which is not perhaps the public image that's known as The Guardian. And I think also on the negative side is the failure really to come up with a strategy of where The Guardian is going. I think they did adopt what on its face was a rather ridiculous notion of becoming the liberal newspaper of the world, particularly the English-speaking world, so particularly America. And actually, I think that's great. That's very good. Crazily optimistic and ambitious, and I don't fault him for that. But I think there are big question marks over the strategy in terms of whether it's going to actually work for The Guardian. I mean commercially. Fair point that an editor is principally worried about the journalism, but actually at The Guardian, Rusbridger's role was the strategy as well. He had a big part in the strategy, and I think the strategy is uncertain. on the plus side for The Guardian overall, I wouldn't be too gloomy for people working there or people who want to see The Guardian succeed. It has serious money to be able to take its time, as it were, to work out its strategy. But I think this is the big job that has to be done. They need to crack that.
Those that might defend Alan would say he's acknowledging the fact that the print media is dead in the long term, and he's doing his best to establish a critical mass of millions of people around the world so that that can be monetized subsequently. And luckily, because of the position with the Scott Trust and the sale of Auto Trade and so on, he's in a unique position to be able to do that.
I think it's right that The Guardian under Alan Rusbridger recognized in a sense that the future, the very basic point that the future is digital. It's not print. And I think Alan Rusbridger has adopted the attitude that, in a sense, the newspaper is the marketing arm for The Guardian, which essentially is a web-based product. I think that's fine, but there's real doubts, I think, about the what the commercial approach is. There have been various strategies to basically raise revenue. Do we have sort of membership clubs that we try and get readers to join? What are we doing? They obviously set their face against charging, but I think that in the end a more sophisticated solution to that will come. In a sense, the FT, I think, has shown the way with charging. Of course, their audience makes it more appropriate, but I think certainly other websites, other newspapers that are developing their websites are developing websites that charge in part, as it were. And there's a mixture of free and material that's charged for.
That whole issue about the paywall is quite interesting, isn't it? Because if you look at what other newspapers have done, specifically The Times and The Sun, which is to limit access to their journalism, it's absolutely the reverse of what The Guardian's policy has been. Their policy is to open up access to the journalism. And I think you're absolutely right. The jury is out about whether or not that is the long-term successful approach for the newspaper. But it's interesting that such a diametrically opposite kind of policy has come into the arena.
And what I say is I'm sure both is wrong. It is not one extreme or the other. I think in the end what's required is a more sophisticated model, under which certainly material is given away for free in order to, as it were, attract people to your product, whether you're The Guardian or The Times, but that there is material that you're publishing for which you're going to charge. And I think it's that mixture. The Times has the advantage of being able to sort of bundle in content with things like Sky, so they have some real commercial advantages, which I'm sure will apply. But set against that, I don't think The Sun is certainly going behind a paywall is quite frankly ridiculous for its market.
The newspaper's kind of finding their way, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And just like models in other parts of the media, the old certainties of how you fund and how you continue to fund and the dependency of your funding structure, it just doesn't work anymore. If you look at the ITV structure, I mean, advertising revenue was declining. They've had to diversify and quite successfully have ranged over a whole different area of ways of funding and continuing to make programs. And for newspapers, I think it's even more difficult because the model that they're under is under threat from all sorts of different platforms. If you think about social media and online content, you don't have to be a newspaper with 150 years of history to occupy a space in the internet world and attract viewers and eyeballs to your content. And actually, even more difficult for a printed form to do that than a broadcast media form.
I mean, one thing that has happened with The Guardian under Alan Rusbridger is to essentially massively increase the marketplace to which they speak. In other words, not just to a liberal audience in the UK, but to a liberal audience across the world. And I think, I mean, that on its face seems crazily ambitious, but I think was a very good move. And I think that they have had some success there. And there's been, one of the big journalistic successes, the Snowden story, of course, absolutely serves that market that it's now going for.
And that's the key, isn't it? It's building your expansion on the back of potentially award-winning journalism. You know, no surprise that the paper's got a Pulitzer Prize at the moment. And if you think about the initiatives that The Guardian has conducted over many years, I can remember, the supplements of taking newspapers from around the world and seeing how they're covering stories. It's just an intelligent way of doing a bit of your journalism and sharing it on other platforms. And the tie-up with other big names in the journalistic world, I think, has been hugely beneficial for the reputation and the Guardian.
Alex, what do you think should be top of the to-do list of his successor? I mean, if the rumours are true and Ian Katz is going to leave Newsnight to go back to the Guardian, he's done some quite innovative things there at Newsnight. What could his successor do to stem the decline, as it were?
Well, I go back to the point I made earlier, which I think is that you've got to invest in the journalism. That's the thing that is going to sell the newspapers. That's the basis of your credibility. And given that they want to expand and they want to reach a wider audience around the world, it's on the back of extremely good journalism that they will be able to do that. So absolutely ensuring that you're investing in the kind of investigations that will deliver front page scoops, that your team is well resourced and has a clear agenda. It seems to me to be the most important priority for any new editor. Set your agenda, put the right people in the right place to deliver on it, and then when you've got the big stories, shout about them.
Alan and The Guardian seem to be in quite a fortunate position insofar as they can afford to invest in actual journalists sitting behind desks in a newsroom, unlike many other newspapers.
Yes, although the great irony of that is that's not entirely what they're doing. There seems to be constant rounds of voluntary redundancies at The Guardian. Now, this is an industry-wide problem, but I find this really odd, because I agree with what you just said there about it's about investing in journalism and it's about the journalism. That's what's in the end going to drive The Guardian forward. And I think, you know, the Snowden revelations is an example of that. Basically, they need more of that kind of material, which will speak to the market that it's trying to reach across the world. But it requires investment in journalism, and although, of course, they, in one sense, they would certainly say they have, because they've developed a big American arm, a big Australian arm, but it remains the case that they're making lots of redundancies, voluntary redundancies, in London, the UK.
It doesn't quite seem to be the bloodbath that they're having, say, at the Telegraph.
No, indeed. I mean, that's right, and, you know, it's a problem for everyone. I think they do need to think about what the strategy is that goes beyond. Certainly, focusing on journalism, that absolutely is the primary job for the editor, to make sure they do more great journalism. But I think the editor also has to be a part in thinking, what do we do beyond trying to appeal to a wide liberal English-speaking audience around the world? Basically, how are we going to monetize this? Because The Guardian needs, in the end, to find a solution to that. It's in the fortunate position that it hasn't got to get it right quickly. They've got time, but they don't want to be coasting.
Alex, do you think there's echoes of when John Major became Prime Minister and Margaret Thatcher said famously she was going to be a backseat driver to the next government? Do you think with Alan becoming chairman of the Scott Trust that the new editor might feel he might be trying to do the same role?
It's always a risk when somebody who has been so dominant in the life of a newsroom moves on, but doesn't move completely away. I mean, I think Alan's already said that he wants to diversify his projects and that he's interested in working probably abroad. I mean,
play more piano.
Exactly, yeah, playing the piano too. So I think it will depend on who takes the editor's seat and how involved they want Alan to be, to a certain extent. But to be honest, if it were me taking over that role, then I'd be grateful for the odd little hint and a bit of advice. And actually, I think sometimes that transitionary period when you're going from one editor to another is as an example when actually coming together and sharing your experience and keeping the momentum going rather than there being a clean cut is actually a positive thing rather than a sense of interfering.
One of the things that it probably is not widely realised outside of the industry is that, in contrast, a lot of editors who are often very, very firmly, as it were, in charge of their publications, despite what some people might try and say at trial, Alan Rusbridge is not like that. He's got quite a light hand at The Guardian. And you mentioned having other interests. That's what he'll want to spend some of his time doing in the future. Well, that's in a sense been true while he's been the editor of The Guardian. So he has not been a hands-on editor. And actually, in a way, that might mean there's less worry, as it were, for his successor. I mean, I'm pretty sure that Janine Gibson will be taking over as editor of The Guardian. She's the deputy now. She set up the American operation. And she's been deputy to Alan Rusbridge and worked with him, you know, for a very, very long time. So I think in those circumstances, it'll be an internal candidate. I don't see a massive problem. I don't really see a problem at all with having Alan Rusbridge as chair of the Scott Trust, and quite the reverse. I think he's very sensible.
Alex, final question. Do you think he's got the timing right?
The timing's always going to be right for when you decide, I guess. And he's expressed an interest in doing other things and moving away from the day-to-day running of the newspaper. So who knows when the time's right? I suppose, you know, you go when you're...
What is interesting about the timing is Ian Katz, his previous deputy editor, asked him exactly that question about 18 months ago. Basically, when are you going to go? Mm-hmm. Can I be the editor? And Alan Rossbridge didn't really answer the question. And obviously, Ian Katz went on to be... he asked the question because he was offered and in the end took the editorship of Newsnight. And you mentioned him earlier. I think it's highly unlikely he'll be the editor of The Guardian, or at least he'll be the next one. I'm not sure he'll even want to apply. And actually, for Newsnight's sake, I hope he doesn't go, because Newsnight's in desperate trouble. And I think having lost Jeremy Paxman, it can't do with losing Ian Katz at this stage either.
So next up, were the national media slow to report the allegations of a VIP paedophile ring? The investigative news website Exero, edited by our guest Mark, no less, is credited for breaking a string of stories about a paedophile network that allegedly operated in the UK for decades. Mark, great work on the story, but why do you think it went unreported for so long?
Well, it's an incredibly difficult story. It's an incredibly difficult story on so many levels. And it would have been incredibly difficult even without the disaster that Newsnight on BBC Two had with the McAlpine episode. In fact, when that happened, we were already beginning our investigation, and we regarded it as an absolute disaster because we could see we were working on a very similar sounding story. Was one going to just lead people to think it's another load of nonsense, as well as it would make it very, very difficult to persuade media partners to work with us on the story. And we already, I mean, we're quite new. We've only been going for 3 years, but we'd already broken some very big stories where we'd worked with, ironically, Newsnight amongst them, Channel 4 News and newspapers. And we foresaw, correctly, as it turned out, that there would be great difficulty in persuading other media outlets to work with us on this story initially. But it did gradually change. I mean, the first thing that changed, really, was one newspaper, the Sunday People. The deputy editor at the time, Nick Buckley, happened to have a couple of key sources who were sources in common, as it were, with us. And so it put him in a slightly different position as a sort of executive, because he knew something about where we were coming from, I suppose. And we were able to get stories to run in the Sunday People. We also got early stories in the Sunday Mirror. But it did take a long time to catch. And in a way, we were fairly relaxed about it, because I think when we did our first stories, we were a bit worried that very quickly the mass of the media would take over and run off with it before too long. We thought we'd have a fairly short period, as it were, to expose what we could and drive it forward. But as it turned out, 2 years later, people are still being very slow to catch up. I mean, it has changed. It really changed when, as a result of a series of stories that we did, the Home Secretary announced in July an overarching inquiry into child sex abuse, which was very triggered, very prompted, much prompted by stories that we'd done. Some MPs had campaigned on it as a result of the material that we'd exposed. And that clearly, it was in itself a significant story, and everyone covered it and needed to cover some of the background to it. And then I think things went up a further gear when, again, as a result of stories that we did, the Met announced that the investigation that it's doing is in part a homicide investigation. And, of course, that it caused a good deal of interest across the media.
Alex, you're responsible for ITV's election night coverage at the moment, but before then you're editor of ITV London News. Is this something where you kind of knew these stories were rumbling on in the background, but you never felt it reached a critical mass where you could then, you had a hook that you could then run the story?
There's no doubt that Exero have made a tremendous amount of progress on exposing this story and have brought new details that that are shocking and extraordinary to air. But I think the story and other stories of a similar vein have been on the radar of journalists and newsrooms for a long period of time. There is something peculiarly difficult about these kind of stories, which require tremendous amounts of time and care in exposing. And I think for many mainstream newsrooms, there is a choice about investing the time and expertise that's required in these kind of stories and this kind of pursuit. And it isn't for every newsroom. Individual editors will make their own minds about whether or not they have the stomach for it, if you like. And I think it's interesting because increasingly these kind of stories, these exclusives, are the currency of what modern journalism, what modern newsrooms deal in. Increasingly, editors, be they print editors or broadcast editors, are looking for the stories that set them apart from the rest of the pack. And it's these kinds of investigations which are increasingly doing that for be it programmes like Newsnight or Channel 4 News or ITV News or the BBC. I think there is a conscious engagement, which I think actually organisations like Exara have helped to increase with difficult-to-tell stories that do stand out from the rest of the news. It's a choice, though, because essentially there are programmes and current affairs programmes which have done that kind of investigative journalism throughout the course of their history. You think about World in Action and the Cook Report and Panorama. They're not news programmes in that sense. They're aimed at a different audience. They're aimed at a different agenda. And there's a balance, I think, for the mainstream news media to tell what's going on a given day, as well as break their own stories and bring their own journalism, exclusive journalism, to air.
I think there's a peculiar feature to the way we've gone about the investigation, which is different from the way current affairs programmes, for example, work. And I speak as somebody who worked on World in Action when it was made by Granada for ITV. And that is that at each step of the way, we have published stories that stand up in their own right, but we don't necessarily know everything. And for sure, I can assure you, we don't. There's a shock. but taking, say, our very first story on the subject was revealing the fact that the police had launched a secret, what was then a secret investigation, into Elm Guest House, which was a guest house that operated in southwest London, and allegations that MPs, including a cabinet-level MP, amongst other very powerful people, had sexually abused boys in the 1980s. Now, when we ran that story, it stood up in its own right, because we knew for sure, I could explain how, but we knew that that is what was going on. Mm. So the story was absolutely solidly right. Now,
those rumours had been circulating in Westminster for as long as the allegations had been going on as well.
That's right, but the story that we wrote at that stage was the police were investigating this, and no one knew that they were doing that. And it was a way of sort of, as it were, breaking some ground on that story. Now, we had no idea whether we'd be writing anything more about the subject. We expected we would be, but it would depend on whether we got anything more to say. And we've always, in a sense, been in this position of, well, if we have something more to say, then we'll say it. And we've essentially done the investigation. You know, we have been investigating this over a period of 2 years and publishing as and when we can. And that's in contrast to the way you'd make a World in Action, where you kind of find out everything you can about the subject, accumulate it all, and then put it all out in one go. And actually, I think with this incredibly difficult subject, I mean, incredibly difficult in many ways, but to tackle journalistically, I think probably can't, or at least it's exceptionally difficult to do in that old style. Whereas I think the breaking it down step by step, publish as you go along, publish as you stand elements up, is the way forward. Now, as I say, we started off by focusing on Elm Guest House and what was going on at Elm Guest House. But over a period of time, it became very clear that Elm Guest House was just one tentacle of this story. Mm. Now, that wasn't clear to us at the very beginning. So when we published that first story, which was stood up in its own right, we didn't know that it was just one tentacle. We know now, but it didn't matter that we didn't know that then, because the story that we wrote was fine so far as it went, and as we found out more, we published more. And I think as we sit here now, in a funny way, I'm much more conscious of, you know, what we're likely to be saying in weeks and months ahead, because we obviously do have, you know, Extra is about, it means to excavate or to dig, and we have been busy excavating and digging, and we've got some sense of what we're finding and some sense of the kinds of things that are going to come out in the weeks and months ahead.
Alex, do you think this is a story that mainstream media couldn't really tackle because it doesn't have the resources anymore? I mean, Panorama suffered vast amounts of redundancies, ITN rightly has lots of lawyers, but then you get smaller websites like Guido Fox and XRO that are more agile, that can really have, you know, the resources to kind of pursue a story. Do you think that this is the future, that both are going to feed off each other in a kind of symbiotic relationship?
I think if that is the future, that's not a bad a relationship to establish. I think mainstream news programmes like Newsnight, Channel 4 News, ITV News to a certain extent, have always worked in partnership. Channel 4 has a particular long-standing experience of working with independent producers who bring stories to them, and then the two together bring it to air. And I think that relationship has been incredibly productive for the programmes and also for the independent producers. I think there's space within the market for all of us to work on digging around and exposing exclusives. You talk about resources, and I think that is a good question. And inevitably, when these things happen, people scratch their heads and say, well, could we have got that story if we'd have thrown more resources at it? And I'm not sure it's a terribly useful kind of stick to beat yourself with, because if you had more resources, you could do endless things. And we exist in the world where we exist, where pressure on finances is part of the media's environment and landscape, and we have to manage our resources to the best of our ability to produce rounded, interesting, engaging programmes. And I think, you know, for the BBC and for ITV in particular, mass market programmes, there is a job to do in telling people what happened on a given day, as well as digging and uncovering the sort of exclusives that Mark has been talking about. And I think you've got to get the balance right.
I mean, Mark, do you think there's something particularly incendiary about the paedophile nature of these allegations that means that traditional media have kind of rightly been a bit frightened? It is such a strong allegation to make against anyone. I mean, I have a friend who used to be the editor of a very prominent Sunday national newspaper, and, you know, after a few drinks, he would always tell me a few things in the cab on the way to the tube. And I asked him once, I said, did anyone ever approach you about Savile? And he said, oh, we had lots of people. He said, and I was confident in myself that he was a paedophile. He said, but on the other hand, you can't just, you know, go ahead and accuse someone of being a paedophile. It's such an incredibly serious allegation to make that we had to make, you know, doubly sure that it was right, and we could never quite make the story stack up.
Yes, well, certainly on Savile, it was the case that certain newspapers felt they were sure that he was a paedophile on the strength of people who had come forward to them over the years. And I'm certainly aware of one paper that did not essentially run that story because of the libel risk and the amount of evidence that would win a libel case, the number of witnesses that you would have testifying, is onerous. And that is what stopped newspapers doing it, even when they were sure in their heart of hearts that it was true. They didn't feel they could be sure enough of winning a defamation action. I think on the wider thing, I mean, you've alluded, both of you, to how rumours about the, say we say, some figures in Westminster have been around for some time. It's clear to us that that's one. Not only is that right, but that there are media organisations that had some degree of knowledge, or at least some notion that there was something in this. And I think it's not just a question of resources. It's not just a question of the libel risk. I think there are other factors at play here. This is a story that is so unbelievably serious, and it's sort of been staring people in the face and yet has been ignored. And I'll just use a parallel to sort of illustrate the point, even though it's a much, much less significant story, although it seemed very significant at the time, and that's MPs' expenses. Now, quite frankly, if any lobby correspondent didn't know that MPs were fleecing their expenses, then I don't know what they were doing. I mean, I was never...
Everyone knew.
And indeed, I was one of those journalists. I was never a lobby correspondent, but I was one of those journalists who would put up stories about examples of MPs fleecing their expenses. And the political editors on any given paper would always knock them back, stop them running in the paper, on the grounds that we all know this. And I would point out, well, it's great that you all know it, but I'm afraid the readers don't. The public doesn't. And I think they'd like to know. And so it proved when the Telegraph finally did expose the sheer gravity, at the sheer scale of the expenses scandal, the public was really outraged. Now, I have to say, you know, here we are in the midst of our investigation into the Westminster paedophile network. This is so much more grave, such a much bigger scandal than MPs' expenses. And I stagger to think what the public's going to think as they learn what people have been doing.
But that's a really interesting point that you make there, that sometimes, you know, you can sort of lull yourself into a bit of almost a false sense of security that these stories are out there and they're common knowledge and everybody's talking about them, has been for years, and there's nothing really that important or impressive or significant in them. And I think it's only, as you say, after the fact, when the details come out and you see the impact that it has out with the public, with readers, with viewers, that you suddenly think, well, actually, we really got that wrong. And let's be clear, it's not a precise art or science, this journalism lark. Sometimes you've got a gut instinct for what's a story, and sometimes you miss them.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually right. It does come down to news judgment. It's about, is this a story or not? And I have to say, I would have thought on the MP's expenses, it plainly obviously was. And on the Westminster Paedophile Network, it even more plainly obviously is. And yet, quite a lot of our friends in the media don't seem to get that.
Very briefly, Matt, just before we move on, obviously I don't want you to scoop yourself, as it were, and spoil your own stories. But what's to come next year, then? You're going to break some big stories, aren't you?
We're working on a lot of material. The arc of this story doesn't just depend on us. I mean, obviously the police are investigating. They're investigating largely because of material that we've come up with. I suspect, although we do have fantastic material that's coming, it may well be the case that the story goes up yet another gear because of developments in the police investigation. I think next year will be the year when the full gravity of this scandal will hit home with the public. It's sort of boiling, but not quite boiled over yet. I think next year that will happen.
Well, clearly a very difficult subject, which is being appropriately and very sensitively handled. So, finally, what was the biggest media story this year? The headlines have been dominated by the police snooping on journalists, the growth of local TV, the phone hacking trial, and the death of BBC Three, at least on terrestrial television, amongst others. Alex, what was your biggest story, and what do you think awaits in 2015?
I'm going to cheat slightly and say that there are two stories which really sort of stand out for me, and they are kind of connected in thematic terms. One is the end of the phone hacking trial, which I think took us all by surprise in its depth and its longevity. And the other is the fall of the fake shake, thanks to the Talisa trial. And I suppose put the two together, and what you come out with is a real change in the perception of how newspapers operate, and a real, a sea change in our relationship as other journalists in that world with newspaper and print, and with readers and what they expect from their newspapers. I don't think, whatever the conclusions of those two cases were, that people's perceptions and feelings about newspapers will ever be quite the same again.
Do you think the fake shake stories actually damaged journalism per se? Because, I mean, there's many stories that subsequently I found out was dodgy. I mean, I consider myself to be quite media literate, but I believed them. I thought that, a gang had tried to kidnap Posh.
Well, they were very credible stories, and part of, I think, the problem for the printed press is that they have kind of created a demand for those sort of stories. You know, the screeching tabloid headlines have almost invited people to come in and, well, not make up stories, then perhaps elaborate on what is actually the truth. And I think part of that section of the tabloid press do have a responsibility in creating a monster of their own making.
Mark, what do you think your biggest story was?
Well, clearly they were two very significant media stories, but actually I'm going to plump for a story that matters enormously to journalists, but I think I'll explain why it should matter enormously to the wider public, and that is the revelations that we've had this year, a series of revelations about how the police have been hacking the phones of journalists in order to find out who their sources are. Now, what they've been doing is getting phone records, which of course they can do entirely legally. It's legal hacking, unlike the News of the World stuff. And in order to find out who journalistic sources are. Now, of course, that's a great worry to journalists. It's an enormous worry to investigative journalists. We know that, shall we say, we've come under some attention at Exero from unwanted interests. But it should matter to the public at large. If you are a whistleblower, you do not want to be exposed as such, invariably. That's normally the case. And if you're an ordinary member of the public, then you absolutely need whistleblowers to come forward. You know, we've spent earlier much of this programme talking about the Westminster paedophile network. Now, the exposure of that is going to rely on whistleblowers. The only thing I think members of the public are going to say to themselves is, why didn't they come forward sooner? So it's crucially important that whistleblowing happens, and the practices of the police to go around snooping on journalists to find out who their confidential sources are is absolutely dreadful for a proper functioning democracy.
Do you think the near universal condemnation of it might curtail it in the future? And obviously journalists themselves are going to be much more mindful of this. I can imagine them having a kind of burner phone like they have in The Wire, don't they, where you have a separate one, that they, a pay and go that the police can't trace. Do you think that this is the public and journalists alike are going to be just a bit better educated on this and just modify their behaviour accordingly?
Well, I think, yes, there'll be sort of modified behaviour by journalists and sources, no doubt. But in terms of whether there'll be much of a clampdown on the police doing this, well, I suspect not. Not much, anyway, because, as I pointed out, they're able to access this material legally, whether it's really appropriate in the circumstances in which they have gathered this material is very much open to question. Only there's no accountability for it.
We're just running out of metaphorical tips. So just very quickly, what's your prediction for next year then, Mark?
Well, returning to the subject of phone hacking and the related issue of allegations of journalists paying bribes, I think the heat is going to increasingly turn on what did the guy at the top know? We at X-Ro did a story last year about Rupert Murdoch admitting to knowing that his newspaper journalists were going around bribing people. And the police, as a consequence, launched an investigation into the state of his knowledge. The most recent trials have turned the attention increasingly on to claims that the company was encouraging people to do things they perhaps shouldn't have been doing, and this was known right at the top. And I think Murdoch's culpability will be the story for next year.
Alex, what's your prediction? Obviously, you're putting together the election night programme. Have you already booked your holiday for the day after?
Or? I have indeed. I can exclusively reveal who wins the election. If only I could do that. I think, no surprise, that my prediction for next year is that we will be talking a great deal about politics, about party leaders and their suitability for running the country. And,
or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof, indeed. And if the first 4 months of the year will be dominated, as you can imagine it will be, by the campaign, I think you can probably predict that a sizable chunk of the rest of the year will be dominated by the denouement of the actual election night. I think it's a fascinating time for anybody who's interested in politics.
So it starts off as who will win, and then afterwards it'll be who did win.
Absolutely. Why did they win? And what on earth do we do now?
And you might well be putting together the second subsequent election night coverage, which might fall a few months later.
I think if you were a betting person, you wouldn't be too far wrong on putting a small wager on a second election before too far down the line.
So, Alex, how do people follow you on Twitter? How do people catch up with what you're up to?
I'm on Twitter, and I tend to tweet about boring and inane stuff rather than work-related stuff. My cycle into work and how near-death experience it was.
Well, every day is a near-death experience.
<you're> not... what's for tea, sunsets, the activities of my kids.
That sounds more interesting than politics, actually, if I'm honest.
I wouldn't bet on it. It's an acquired taste.
So what's your Twitter ID?
I'm Alex and Lisa. Odd, you might say. But Lisa is my wife, and when I got onto Twitter back in 2008, before many people were really using it, I kind of thought that we would use it jointly as an antidote to Facebook, which I'm not on. And it didn't happen that way. She thought that it was a pointless exercise and a waste of time. So the handle has stayed, and even though it doesn't say very much about me or what I do.
Okay, Mark, what about your good self?
Well, I do encourage people to follow XRO at XRO News on Twitter. And, of course, the website is www.xronews.com. People can also sign up to newsletters so that they can keep up to date with stories that we have broken. I think we do those every other week just to give a quick rundown of what has come out. And we tend to keep things posted. When a story goes up, we tend to post on Twitter. I do have a Twitter account myself. It's, I think, from memory, it's @MarkWatts_1 or something very much like it.
I think it is something like that, as I remember. It's unusual. I think you were beaten to Mark Watts by another Mark Watts. It's the same with me.
I joined much later than you, I have to say.
Well, indeed. Well, I'm the same.
Being earlier,
I'm at Paul W.R. Blanchard, because there's another Paul Blanchard who I hate, who beat me to it. So as I say, if anyone does want to follow me personally, I'm at Paul W.R. Blanchard. Also, you can visit the website mediafocus.org.uk, where you can leave your email address and receive a shiny email once a fortnight letting you know that the new podcast is out. But that's it for this podcast. Thanks ever so much for listening, and we'll catch you next year. The associate producer was Jordan Greenway. I'm Paul Blanchard. Catch you next time.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!